Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Arthur Penn and his 1967 classic, Bonnie and Clyde. Returning on the show today to talk about Bonnie and Clyde is Professor Mike Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So this is definitely, I think, when you're studying movies, this is one of those films that's like a big landmark, you know, like a Jaws or a Star Wars, that this is sort of where you see the death of the old Hollywood system and you're seeing the birth of the new what was defined as the new Hollywood era in the late 60s, early 70s.
Exactly. This film was made for academics, if you will. By that, I mean, when we teach our Intro to American Cinema course, this is on the list because we basically go decade by decade. And when you get to the 1960s, there's that short list of which films you absolutely need on the screen and certainly in the textbook and in discussion. And for me, it's Bonnie and Clyde. And, you know, as we talk about how Hollywood is changing from the studio era into the modern era, if you will, this is such a landmark film. I mean, in itself, it's a great film. It's such a classic. But it also has that value of a kind of sociological value. It really gives you a sense of how the turf is changing, how the value system, how the names and faces, everything is changing in Hollywood. And not that it would be simplistic to say this is the film, but in some ways it is.
Yeah, because you just... It's not only a product of its time because, you know, even though it's about these true life bank robbers in the 1930s, it can be really, it's almost like a, you know, symbolic for the 60s counterculture, like Bonnie and Clyde or like the hippies and whatever. And it's very similar when I'm watching this, it's kind of similar the way when you watch the movie or the TV show MASH, where even though that's about the Korean War, what it's really about is Vietnam.
I feel as if you've stolen my lecture notes. No, the reason I say that is actually this is a film that is released in 1967. Of course, it involves the real-life Bonnie and Clyde from the early 1930s. It's very much a period piece. In most ways, it's very true to their actual story and their circumstances. Some changes made for the sake of dramatic license and so on. But as you say, it's a kind of curious fusion because you wouldn't think that young kids going to the movies in the late 60s would automatically have an interest in something that goes back to their parents' or grandparents' generation, but they're the ones who made this a hit movie. And somehow that countercultural movement adopted or responded to this film in a way that turned Bonnie and Clyde into cultural heroes. It really was not particularly well received critically, a mixed reception when it first came out. The initial box office was not all that great. It was the word of mouth among college kids, basically. And then once it caught on, it was wildfire, as they say, the proverbial wildfire. And to give just one quick example of many we could as to how it became a cultural phenomenon, if you look at fashion magazines from that period onward, the next few years in particular, you'll see fashion spreads there where there will be a model dressed up like Bonnie Parker, like the Faye Dunaway character. She'll be wearing the same kind of tight dress, the same beret cocked at a jaunty angle on her head. She'll probably have her foot on the running board of some old car. She'll have a cigar in one hand and a Tommy gun in the other. And you know what? This really is a fashion spread. But young American women in particular kind of responded to that. They went in for that Bonnie Parker look. And so here you have young American women, college age girls, if you will, in the late 60s, dressing up like a gangster from the early 1930s. That says something about the culture and probably something their parents would be nervous about.
Yeah, and I would say watching this film now, it's the one I do like this movie. I don't want to say I don't like it, but always one of the criticism I have of this movie, it seems to sugarcoat the real life story of Bonnie and Clyde. I feel, once again, I'm not an expert on Bonnie and Clyde, but it does feel that they seem to simplify them and make them more Robin Hood characters when it's really like they were just doing this for the money and they didn't give any money to the poor or stand up for the people who were screwed over by the banks.
But you know, that myth-making process began in Bonnie and Clyde's own day. Some of the things done in the film are purely done by way of a kind of editorial concision. By that I mean the actual Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow had a kind of tangled early relationship in terms of when they first met. You know, one is in jail, the other's out, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of an extended story. If you truly told that in a kind of real-time, rap sheet way, it'd be a five-hour film. So the dramatic concision there is perfectly justifiable, namely that she looks out her window one day at the very opening of the movie. He's out there trying to steal her family's car.
Yeah.
That's somehow the meet-cute situation. And she's so bored as a West Dallas waitress, she takes off with him. It's true psychologically to the dynamics of the relationship, but it definitely is telescoped that way. Also, of course, when you look at photographs of the real Bonnie and Clyde, they weren't bad looking, but they weren't movie star handsome.
Not Warren Beatty and
Exactly. So it absolutely does romanticize and glamorize all that. You're absolutely correct. But you know what? That process began during Bonnie and Clyde's lifetime. After all, they, in their own way, they didn't have the semantics, the vocabulary we have in terms of how media operate, but they were media savvy.
Mm-hmm.
And as they were robbing banks like that, they became front page news. And I'll tell you what, during the Depression, so many people, out of work, out of luck, and so on, could be amused by the exploits of Bonnie and Clyde, could at least be engaged by it, could turn them into folk heroes, essentially. So much so that after they were killed, and we all know the horrible specifics of that shootout with, you know, the car getting more than enough bullets to stop it, let's put it that way. After that happened, the car itself became a carnival sideshow attraction. It was actually, somehow it got out of state hands, if you will, and into private hands, and it was taken on the carnival circuit. And people would pay money to enter the tent, if you will, and have a look at the actual car in which Bonnie and Clyde were shot dead. That's a myth-making process. And you know what? Mm-hmm. It explains why all these decades after their deaths, they're on that short list of famous gangsters like Al Capone from the early 30s, whose names are still known to everyone today. Whether young or old, we recognize those names. So you're absolutely right that when Warren Beatty and Arthur Penn made the film in 67, they were simplifying and glorifying things. But essentially, on a kind of psychological level, what they were doing was totally in sync with how people responded to Bonnie and Clyde back then. Now, in terms of the actual lives and deaths of Bonnie and Clyde, the movie is more or less faithful to that. The one major change that they made creatively, and it really does give the movie a more contemporary vibe, is in the film, to put it politely and mildly, Clyde has problems performing. He's good with a machine gun, but when it comes to romancing women, he doesn't quite follow. He has great looks and you know, picks them up, but there's not quite the follow through, to put it politely. And she's, of course, totally discombobulated by that. What's the matter here? What's the problem? That whole issue of sexual dysfunction was totally made up for the film. And Warren Beatty and Arthur Penn were always upfront about that. It's not like they're trying to cover their tracks. Warren Beatty once in an interview said, well, we wanted to like really make it not only true to their lives, but we wanted to update it in some ways or make it more nuanced, more complicated. And we thought, rather than just sort of like black and white polarities of, you know, gangsters and cops and blah, 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 why not have this kind of internal conflict within Clyde, if you will, that he's so macho and assertive in some ways, but can't quite follow through in a manly way otherwise, and how that would totally throw off Bonnie, and how really audiences in the late 60s, which were receptive to more nuanced and complicated tales of human sexuality, would respond to it. So in other words, they're thinking like, well, nowadays people really are starting to question, you know, sexual identity, and beyond that, just simply our being that way. We can be more honest and open about such matters. And the film is going to at least bring that up as a topic. And it really is one of the defining traits of their relationship, isn't it, within the film? But again, that really does take it totally away from the original Bonnie and Clyde. There's no indication whatsoever historically that, you know, that was an issue for them. So again, filmmakers are artists and they will take creative license. And that's one place where they took it. And to their credit, I mean, I think it works in the film, but especially to their credit, it's not like they tried to pretend otherwise. They were always up front and saying, yeah, we added that.
Yeah, and when you're talking about, you know, the real-life Bonnie and Clyde and how, you know, people at the time might have seen them as folk heroes, the way they were sort of sticking it to the banks, it's very similar to one of my all-time favorite movies, is The Assassination of Jesse James, the way the real-life Jesse James was portrayed as this Robin Hood, and even like you were talking about, even like they were doing, Robert Ford was doing plays on how he killed Jesse James, and Jesse James's body was preserved in ice and had toured throughout the country. It still has that huge folk heroes where he's similar to a Bonnie and Clyde or a Dillinger or Capone.
Well, here's a very specific example of how the filmmakers were riding the zeitgeist in 67. Arthur Penn, the director of the film, in an interview in 1967, as the film's just coming out, he said this, quote, "The only people who really interest me are the outcasts from society. The people who are not outcasts, either psychologically, emotionally, or physically, seem to me good material for selling breakfast food, but they're not material for films. What I'm really trying to say through the figure of the outcast is that a society has its mirror in its outcasts. A society would be wise to pay attention to the people who do not belong in it if it wants to find out what its configuration is and where it's failing," close quote. So this is another indication of how, particularly for filmmakers, artists in general in the late 60s, yeah, they are thinking in very countercultural terms, going up against the system. What do we make of gangsters who go up against the system that way? Again, during the Great Depression, you could say, well, these gangsters, and again, in the course I mentioned earlier, we also show the original Scarface from 1932, too, so we have a sense of the genre itself changing and not changing, if you will, how that kind of anti-hero figure goes up against the system. After all, the United States government, the economy, everything had failed during the Depression. You know, why not go out and grab yours, get yours, make it in society? And likewise for Bonnie and Clyde, you know, viewed through a late 1960s lens, as these kids were protesting the war in Vietnam and protesting all sorts of things, protesting their parents, certainly. Here's a film in which the outcasts, the people who break the law, in some ways, not just in some ways, in most ways, are presented as the good guys. Clyde makes a point of saying that he's not a killer. He doesn't want to be a killer. You know, robbing banks is his profession, his occupation. He's really proud of it. The only thing he does better than robbing the bank, he says, is getting away. Yeah. You know, and so he's really proud of it. And that Bonnie and Clyde, you know, that sexual dysfunction is a big issue. But aside from that, if we can put it that way, aside from that, they really do have a very close emotional bond. And we get to know them and care about them in a way that most of the law enforcement officials in a film like this are either anonymous, or if they do have a name and an identity, they're vile, they're corrupt.
Yeah, the
Texas Ranger.
Yeah, and I believe in that guy is actually based on a real life character.
He is.
And he wasn't the kind of the mean guy that the square that he's portrayed in the movie.
Well, that's another case where they are sharpening the characterizations in a way that you're right, may not frankly be totally true to the identity of the original, but in the fictive reimagining of it, the Texas Ranger is somebody who, and not just the Texas Ranger, there are other cops in the film, when they're chasing Bonnie and Clyde, are they looking to uphold law and order?
They
and
shoot first, ask questions later.
Well, two things. Number one, they tend to shoot first and ask questions later or not ask questions. But the second thing is, because there's a bounty on them, they're in it for the money as much as anything. And that's why a crucial issue in this film has to do with crossing the state line. For Bonnie and Clyde, in fact, late in the film, Bonnie, in a very tender moment, she's asking Clyde, you know, if you had to do it all over again, would you do anything differently? And she really doesn't want to be in this anymore. She wants out, but it's too late. You know, they're killers and they're on the run and it's too late to pull out. And she knows that, but she's saying to him in a kind of wistful way, if you could do it over again, what would you do differently? And she's hoping to hear him say something like, well, I'd have a straight job and we'd obey the law and we'd have kids and live near my mom and this and that. But no, what he says is, well, if we had to do it all over again, he says, you know what? We would live in one state and commit our bank robberies in another state. We would always, you know, like division, like your work life and your private life, like keep the state line. The reason I keep harping on the state line is that's a real issue for law enforcement here. There's one scene in particular where two cops are chasing them and it's approaching the state line and Bonnie and Clyde are headed over the state line. And the cops initially are going to keep going, like, if we can capture them, we can get the bounty, we can get money. But then they sort of reconsider, like, well, no, do you really want to put your life on the line here? And they turn around at the state line. They don't keep going across after them. But the Texas Ranger, when he initially is captured and taunted and humiliated by Bonnie and Clyde, it's really a disturbing episode. I mean, how they punish him that way and then take his picture for good measure, you know, the humiliation. He's in another state. It's Oklahoma at that point. He's crossed the state state line. Why is he doing it? Is it law and order? No, he's in it for the money, for the bounty. So here's the good guys are not so good in the dramatic telling of this story. And it just reinforces our emotional identification with Bonnie and Clyde. They're upfront about being bank robbers and what they do. And if that's a defense, well, at least, or not, we can debate. But they're right up front about it. Whereas the forces of law and order, they've got the uniforms and they talk about upholding the law. But we see several scenes in which it's obvious that they're in it for the money.
Oh, definitely. And once again, this is once again showing how, like, imagine just like five years earlier, there's no way this could have been put on film. But because the Hays Code was now done, and you have the modern rating system, how you can, you know, show, you know, more upfront sexual content, you can show violence, you can show, like, law enforcement not always being good. And
but you know what? You actually technically could not at the point this film was in production and honestly was released. It's a transitional moment. As a reminder, the Hays Code that you're referring to, the Hays Office, that production code was formulated in 1930, didn't really have teeth in it until 1934. That's why people talk about pre-code films from the early 30s, which could be rather saucy, couldn't they?
Oh, yes.
They can be. I love those films. They're so risque, and they're just really good-natured about it, right?
Yeah.
Whether comedies or dramas, they're good-natured about it. But anyway, by the early to mid-60s, because of changing social conditions and taste, if I can put it that way, Hollywood was responding to it. Movies were getting more assertive, blunter. Because after all, go back to the early 50s, and when Otto Preminger, a very independent-minded mainstream producer, was producing and directing a movie, The Moon is Blue, simply the use of the word virgin in that had the film denied the production code seal of approval, just for using the word virgin, just to use the word. I mean, there are many examples to give, but that's a really striking one. And so in a case like that, you might end up releasing the film without the seal of approval, meaning a lot of theaters wouldn't play it and so on. But anyway, cutting ahead, you get to the mid to late 60s, and things are changing so much. The old production code cannot deal with that. I'll tell you why. If you actually read the code, it's great reading, actually. If you actually read the code line by line, and they're just wonderful examples of how uptight it is about sex and violence and patriotism and you name it.
No toilets.
Oh, no. That's why you will never see it. One of the shocking things about Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960 was that it has a close-up shot of a toilet, which is considered a cinematic first in Hollywood. That's actually the most shocking thing in the film. Never mind that Janet Leigh is killed in that bathroom. It's the toilet bowl. Because in mainstream Hollywood movies, for decades, people never went to the bathroom. It's just an amazing fact of life. And you would never show something like that. And Hitchcock, who had a naughty sense of humor, was already kind of pushing the envelope with the production code when he had that shot. And there's a reason, as you know, within the story why you should be showing the bowl, if you will. But it was just verboten for most filmmakers. But anyway, things like that, which, you know, there's so many silly and kind of shocking examples of the production code. But you get to the mid-60s and something's got to give. And this is the time when Hollywood knew that the old code was just no longer enforceable. And the real problem here is this. The production code is an everything or nothing gambit. In other words, if you have anything in your film that goes against the code, your film will not receive that seal of approval. As you know, you would actually see that seal on the screen that had been approved. And therefore, mainstream movie theaters, meaning the great majority of them, would not show your film. Secondly, newspapers would not carry advertising for it. I mean, and this is a self-imposed code. It goes back to the controversies of the late 20s and early 30s. Hollywood was so afraid that Washington would dictate terms, that Washington would be a censor, in effect, that Hollywood said, don't worry, we'll take care of our own. So the whole notion behind the Hays office, and after all, Hays himself had been a federal official back in the 20s, we're going to hire an ex-government man to run our censorship operation, and we'll handle it out here in Hollywood so you don't have to. We've always had that separation of powers, if you will, Washington and Hollywood, not to have the one tamper with the other in the way Hollywood, and, you know, because in other countries, the national government would intervene directly. And we didn't want that for all kinds of valid reasons. So anyway, the production code goes in. But see, the real problem there is if you violate any aspect of the code, you don't get the seal. And then if you don't get the seal, in effect, you don't get a mainstream commercial release. And that so things weren't playing out that way. And it's a changing of the guard. The new Hollywood is coming in. It very much wants to be more open about sexuality, violence, right down the line. The old order is still there. not just with the production code, but in the studios themselves. Here's a quick reminder. Think back to the gangster movies of the early 1930s. Those were almost all produced by Warner Brothers, who were actual brothers, and had a socially progressive, pro-FDR kind of stance in all sorts of ways, but also, by way of scuttlebutt, were not averse to a little bit of gambling and so on their own. Not that they were gangsters, but they had friends who were, they knew of. So they, let's put it this way. They knew the material, okay?
Yeah.
And so here's the really striking thing. Warner Brothers is producing those early gangster movies like Public Enemy and Scarface and so on, early 1930s. The head of production is Jack Warner. Other brothers come and go. Sam dies, for instance. But you know what? In the early to mid-1960s, who's still on the lot as head of production? Jack Warner. So when Warren Beatty brings this project to him, here's a sign of New Hollywood. Warren Beatty was a bona fide movie star at this point, had been for a few years. Warren Beatty, as an actor with some clout, decides he wants to produce this movie. Here we go. Here's the change right here. You have an actor who not only is no longer under the old-fashioned studio contracts and all those restrictions, but he is a sort of independent operator, and moreover, he wants to sit in the producer's chair. It's Warren Beatty who actually hires Arthur Penn to be the director. That's how much power he has here. But still, it's a studio film. So this is a story that Arthur Penn liked to tell, and it involves Warren Beatty as the star and producer of Bonnie and Clyde, trying to convince, essentially trying to manipulate the longtime studio chief, Jack Warner, into making the film because it's studio financed. So here's how Arthur Penn told the story. Jack Warner did not like the film, could not figure it out at all. Warren was very clever. He told him that the film was an homage to the gangster films of Warner's past. Yeah. And Jack Warner said, "What's an homage?" Now, that's a very telling anecdote because, you know, he just didn't get it. Here's a guy who produced all those old gangster movies, but this is a new kind of gangster film. And in terms of the sexuality, the violence, the whatever, Jack Warner just didn't get it. And that's really striking here, that in terms of the violence in the film and just the overall tenor of it, the old production code and the old producers didn't know what to do with this. So Bonnie and Clyde did receive the production code seal with great apprehension, but it's no coincidence that 1967 was the last year in which the production code was still in force. Everything changes in 1968. The production code is scuttled, and the current rating system, with a few modifications over the decades, but the current rating system is something that went into place in 1968. Jack Valenti, the former LBJ assistant, you know, put in charge of the censorship code and of the MPAA. And at that point, you know, 1968, we head into what I call the modern era in terms of how we handle things like that. No longer is the production code there. The modern rating system is. And again, with some tinkering over the years, it's what we still have. And the crucial distinction here is, again, the production code was an all or nothing thing. The modern rating system, as you know, of course has levels of viewership, to put it that way. You know, what's for all, you know, because the old production code was for general audiences, so that once you had that seal of approval, everybody from a small child up to grandpa, everybody could go see it, right?
Yep.
And our modern system, as you know, has got those levels or layers where what's considered appropriate, everything from G up to X, which became NC-17. And that's a very different way of approaching it. So by the time, and again, in 67, between films like this and The Graduate and so on, clearly something had to give, and it was the production code that gave. Just further reinforcement that not everybody quite got what this movie was about or what it was doing. As I said earlier, the mainstream movie critics were really split on this. Some people liked it and saw what was really going on. It's a great film. Others were kind of mixed, and some were hostile, actually, you know, outright dismissive. Is this the place where we should talk about Bosley Crowther?
Yeah, go ahead. I guess for a little bit of background, Bosley Crowther was sort of like the first big film critic. Like, he was even before, like, Ebert and Cale and everybody, right?
Well, the New York Times actually had some film critics going back to the 30s and early 40s whose names would have been known just as being, you know, critical voices in the Times. But the thing about Bosley Crowther is that he was among that first generation, or I'd say maybe a little bit after that, you know. But your point's correct in the sense that once he took the job, he kept it.
Yeah.
And so for many years, he is the lead film critic at the New York Times. And having read many of his reviews, because, you know, when you're researching films, it's always of interest to see what the initial critical response was. And looking back over the years, I became convinced, and I have friends who feel the same way, and we like to laugh about this, that it's what I consider an inverse barometer. By that I mean, if Bosley Crowther likes something, you know you're going to hate it. If he hates it, you're going to love it. He was wrong on so many important films that I think he's quite useful that way. He's quite valuable that way. And so as an inverse barometer, and again, he was the most important critical voice in the country, after all, New York Times, when this film came out in 1967, Bosley Crowther wrote that the film was, quote, as pointless as it is lacking in taste, close quote. Well, it certainly, by his standard, was lacking in taste. And that was kind of, and the only thing that, what really changed there was, that's how the establishment viewed it. Whether it's Jack Warner at the studio or Bosley Crowther at the New York Times, they don't get it. They really don't get it. And what changes there is that they don't get the film, but they do understand money. And when audiences turn out, and it's word of mouth that makes this film a hit, when the college kids go and go again and tell their friends and dress like Bonnie Parker and all that, you know what? The film holds on and it becomes, and some of the critics actually would write about the film on first release and then revisit it months later and write about it again. And people did come around to it that way. So it became a major box office hit and certainly critically as well. And, you know, enough people would have realized it's a cultural landmark, really. And that generation, the Jack Warners and Bosley Crowthers, they really kind of go into the dustbin of history in the sense that whatever merits they had, and they did have merits going back decades, they were of that older generation. It's the generation gap, right? They don't get this new crowd. They don't know what the kids are up to, and it's precisely why the kids are protesting.
Yeah, and so for the later generation of film critics, I know Ebert was sort of starting out at the time, Kale was one of the first critics that she really embraced the new Hollywood. What did they think of this movie?
Well, yeah, that's the next generation of critics that not only embraced it, but really advocated. It's a kind of missionary work, if you will. And certainly Ebert and Pauline Kael and some others, Andrew Saris and so on, they realize the importance of films like this. And it, again, it's not just the initial reviews. And again, at the time this film came out, it predates Kael's tenure really at the New Yorker magazine, but not by too much. She's writing about film at that time. She's starting to write for the New Yorker in that period. But in the years after that, it's partly a matter then of also revisiting the film, where even if critics weren't on the scene or not on the scene for the publications for which they're best known, their voices were out there, absolutely. And then in the years since then, for instance, when they write about similar films, late 60s, early 70s, this film is oftentimes mentioned within the context of reviewing then more recent films. See, what I'm getting at there is that it's part of the cultural discussion that, you know, a film comes out in the early 70s when they're firing on all cylinders, you know, whether she at the New Yorker or, you know, Ebert and so on in Chicago. At that point, they really are firmly established and you know, really nationally known media voices. And at that point, they're always bringing a film like this into the discussion. So that's actually why, or one reason why it has a kind of staying power. Because some movies get a lot of attention, whether positive or negative, when they first come out, and then just kind of like drop off or sort of, you know, they get a little dusty that way. But this is a film that remained really vivid and viable because earlier, as you mentioned, some other films or things like MASH and so on, it really helps to change the climate in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So that by the end of the 60s, it's not surprising that you'd have Midnight Cowboy in 69 winning the Academy Award for Best Picture, or a film like Easy Rider in that same year, or The Wild Bunch that same year. Films with a lot of sex, a lot of violence, a lot of envelope pushing, which, you know, it's still risky or risque, but you know what? It's increasingly the norm. And it's that newer generation that has not only taken over in Hollywood by then, but also has taken over the media landscape. So yes, certainly by that point, whether it's Pauline Kael, Roger Ebert, several others, some of whom have been around for a while, like Andrew Saris, but in any event, at this point, they've got a lot of clout This is a period when people actually read film critics and take them seriously. And for me, it's sort of a golden age, and I have kind of nostalgia for that because they really had an influence. Nowadays, we have more of the aggregate of film criticism.
Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, when I want to argue over movies, which I love to do, and I want to really get into the aesthetics of it and argue back and forth, I'll try to make what I think is a good argument. And the person at the other end just gives me a percentage from Rotten Tomatoes. And that becomes the counter argument. I say, well, I'm up against 78%. What can I do with that? And so that's what's known as aggregate criticism. But back then, you had a handful of truly powerful, truly influential film critics who happened to write extremely well, who oftentimes did not agree with each other. That's part of the fun of it. It's a long-running dispute between Saris and Kale. Books are written about such things. But what's, for our purposes, useful there is that they were critically engaged. They wanted to talk about film as an art form and as a business. And because they wrote so well, and because they had such keen intellect, if I can put it that way, they really made arguments that you had to follow, you had to pay attention to. And yes, they wrote long reviews. People actually write consecutive paragraphs. It's shocking now.
And it was funny because you were talking about Crowther, and you said how, if he liked a film, it means stay away. And if he hated a film, it means you got to go see it. It sort of reminds me a little bit. Today you have a very kind of a contrarian film critic is a guy named Armand White. And he's a guy where usually if a movie's unanimously praised, he's going to hate it. And if a movie's usually unanimously hated, he's going to, for some reason, give it praise.
Well, you know what? I enjoy reading him. And again, I probably disagree as often as I agree with him, but that's just, personal taste. But that's actually also one reason why I do follow him, because he's really interesting. And sometimes I vehemently disagree, but I keep reading. And in other words, he's smart and he expresses himself well and he has a definite take on things. And I'm on a different wavelength, perhaps, but I want to know what he's saying. And what's really amusing there is in Film Comment magazine, for instance, they'll do a critical roundup every issue where they'll have five or six critics across the spectrum, daily newspapers, websites, you name it. Some of them are big name critics. Some of them are more, alternative publications or outlets and so on. But Armand White's often included in that number. And the reason I'm prompted to remember that is there have been times where let's say there's some hot button new film and they're kind of surveying what five critics had to say about it. And four of them all have the same opinion. They all sort of share the party line. And there's Armand White is the outlier. And I always smile at that thinking, well, good for him in a way. He hangs in there and he makes himself known. And that's a good, healthy kind of corrective in the sense that even if there's sort of a mainline position on something and, we all think it's a great film, blah, 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 he'd be the guy who'd say, well, no, I don't think so. And at a party, you could spend a good hour or two arguing with somebody like that. And rather than being angry with the person, you'd say, well, could I get you another drink? Let's argue some more.
He's the one out of five doctors that don't agree.
Well, I'm not sure I'd want to have my doctors disagreeing that way, but my film critics, that's fine. But if I'm there on the operating table and four of the doctors say do this and the fifth says do that, I might be a little nervous about that.
And we could stay a little bit on the topic of film criticism. We've talked about how it's crazy how it just, because of the new media, it's just sort of exploded into all these different people. Like you go on YouTube, there's thousands and thousands of critics. There are some I think that are very good. I really like, for example, Red Letter Media. But I think there's also a lot who just get hyped for a small number of big budget films, and their criticisms are pretty weak, I would say.
Well, I'm oftentimes looking to see what all those many thousands of people are saying online, and it's kind of an ironic situation. It's sort of the perils and pitfalls of electronic democracy in a way. If you want to pit this one side against the other, there was something very clubby and kind of snobbish and elitist, to use that loaded word, and so on, about the older setup, the legacy media, if I can condemn us with that term, or label us with that term at least. But in any event, it was manageable. And from my perspective, whether I agree or disagree, I have tremendous respect. I actually met Pauline Kael once, and it's like meeting, somebody on Mount Olympus. there's that kind of respect that I had. I absolutely adore her as a writer. Again, I oftentimes disagree disagreed, but my God, she was so readable, and I loved, you know, picking fights mm-hmm. that way. But what I'm getting at is it was a manageable pantheon, a critical pantheon. You had, you know, a handful of really major critics at major publications, and you really paid attention to what they had to say. And there were a lot of other critics as well, but you had that kind of lineup there. Nowadays, it's the exact opposite, and there still are some mainstream critics who fill those same jobs, actually, mm-hmm. at the same publications. I mean, Anthony Lane at The New Yorker is a really good film critic. You still have that. But with our changing media landscape, because so much now is online and opened up in various ways, from my perspective, that's a mixed blessing. And I'll tell you why, because now there's also a lot of what I call white noise. There's just a lot out there, a lot of voices bouncing around. Who knows what to make of it, who to respect, if 78% mm-hmm. in Rotten Tomatoes is something that should mean much to me in terms of who's actually comprising that percentage. Yeah. It's sort of a garden variety thing. And again, it would be terribly snobbish to say that Joe Schmo sitting in his basement with a podcast or something is somehow, you know, not in the know. I mean, that guy might be just as insightful, just as bright as anyone with a famous celebrity name, you know, as a film critic. So I'm being careful as I say that. But by the same token, when you have so many voices out there shouting into the wind like that, who do you pay attention to? Yeah. What does it mean? You know what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Just on a very basic consumer level, I might just sort of like either shut it off, or secondly, listen to it and not know quite what to make of it, or thirdly, just give myself over to the aggregate film criticism model, as in, you know, 8 out of 10 doctors recommend, and just simply go with the percentages and not worry about it otherwise. Well, hey, if 78% of the people love this, who am I to go against that? Unless I'm Mormon white, and then I would pride myself on being in the minority there.
And you do agree, I think, with you know, with criticism today, it's whenever a movie comes out, there's always a few people, like I mentioned earlier, Red Letter Media, who I usually go to. It's like, well, do they like this movie? Because then I can usually gauge, well, maybe I should go see this, or maybe I should maybe wait till it comes out on home video or whatever. You always need to have that select few. You can't just listen to everybody, but if you have a few you like, then you stick with them.
Well, I go to see everything released commercially, so I'm suffering so that you don't have to. But in terms of my reading, I do the same thing, frankly. I mean, I always read the critics in the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine. I'm old-fashioned that way, and unashamed of being old-fashioned that way. That those are really good, really reliable critics. By reliable, again, I may not always agree, but I get a good basic sense of what this film's about, how they responded, and how I'm likely to. And at the level of consumer journalism, that is valuable. I mean, I'm going to see the films anyway, but if I were picking and choosing that way, you're absolutely right. I would know that based on what they wrote, I don't have to go see this weekend at the theater. Maybe I'll just wait to, you know, within a matter of weeks at this point, right, when it's available elsewhere. And so that's a real value that it has. So again, that old critical establishment, that old structure, has some new names in it, but it's still there. It's just a matter that now we have so many more outlets that I think what happens there is that viewers and readers need to be discerning, need to use their own critical smarts here, as in, well, maybe all opinions are not created equal.
Yeah.
If you have somebody writing for, and fill in the blank here, somebody you respect as a critical voice, that should count for something, and maybe for a bit more than just some, you know, anonymous name bouncing out there, you know, shouting into the wind. You know, maybe there's something to be said for a kind of ranking like that. But by the same token, don't discount somebody you've never heard of who on some obscure outlet, because it might be a really sharp cookie, you know, someone
Definitely.
Who really knows what she's talking about, and you should pay attention to it.
Okay. I guess we could get back a little bit towards Bonnie and Clyde. You know, you talked earlier about, you know, how this was an example of New Hollywood. And like another films they usually kind of run in my mind with, they have the very similar anti-establishment is Cool Hand Luke, which just came out the year before, and then The Wild Bunch, and then Easy Rider. I'll be honest, I can't stand that movie, but that is definitely...
Oh, I love that film. Oh, we should argue about it.
I mean, we should do a show then, because I hate that movie so
much. We'll do a five-hour show about that.
But yeah,
I know people who hate it, and I really, I've always liked it, and now I've seen it so many times, I think it's such a great film, but it can be a tough argument to make because it doesn't fit into a conventional box for greatness at all.
No, not at all. We'll have to do a show.
It helps to be high while you're watching it, but it's not necessary. I mean, when I use it in the classroom, I'm totally sober, I hasten to say. And the thing is, though, I mean, I really think it holds up to analysis, but it's not an easy sell for a lot of viewers. You're absolutely right. I've had people tell me they thought it was the worst thing they ever saw in their lives.
Oh, yeah.
And I say, good, let's argue.
You know, because I remember one of the film classes I took, that was one of the movies we had to watch. And I just remember the day after we had to watch it for homework, and we came back, and everybody just in the class is like, oh God, this was so stupid. I hated this movie so much.
Well, I've had that feat. I used it for quite a few years in a course I taught, and I would wear body armor when I went for the discussion. I was accustomed to negative feedback, let's put it that way. And joking aside, I actually really enjoy arguing over that film, so we should argue over it
definitely
sometime.
I'm looking forward to do a show on that. I mean, even though I have to watch it again, I would definitely want to do
a show. To watch again. I mean, your hatred is still vivid. You don't have to watch it again.
And, you know, not only, I think one of the biggest, and we talk about the new Hollywood, one thing I want to talk about is a little bit how you can feel, I don't think new Hollywood would exist without the French New Wave. And I think you can definitely see a lot of that, especially in the editing, especially look at the death scene in a way that's very choppy on purpose, you know, as we see them get shot to death.
Well,
it feels like a Godard film, like Breathless.
Speaking of Jean-Luc Godard, speaking of François Truffaut, Warren Beatty, a very smart guy, was aware of those films. That French New Wave, I mean, not only was released in art houses in this country, but filmmakers and actors and so on, they really, really watched that stuff. They thought about more casual camera work. They thought about shooting on location. They thought about films becoming more realistic in terms of sex and violence and other things. So that influence was actually very direct here. Warren Beatty actually had the accounts vary here. There are different stories told. But what they all have in common is that Warren Beatty not only was aware of that, but tried to recruit Truffaut and or Godard to actually direct Bonnie and Clyde. And we do know that there was contact there, and how serious it was, whether Godard would have said yes to it and so on. Again, it's hard to be dogmatic as to how serious the negotiations were, but there was direct contact. There were conversations. By some accounts, Godard or Truffaut would have been actually in the director's chair or slated to be. Didn't work out. This film was in development for a few years, and when you read about it, there's a lot. I don't want to say it's slippery, but a lot is changing, evolving in the script and the casting and who's going to be the director and so on. And so we could have had a French New Wave director for Bonnie and Clyde. You know, as it is, you know, Hollywood would continue to flirt with those directors to get them here to do one thing or another. And then, of course, ironically, Truffaut finally ends up in Close Encounters of the Third Kind as an actor.
And he also directed the Fahrenheit 451 movie.
He did. Yeah. That's 1966,
six,
right? Yeah, he did. It's English language. It's not really a Hollywood film per se. Well, it's English language. It's you know, more or less American-style filmmaking. Hollywood was calling, and because he had directed that in the mid-60s and could work well with English language actors and so on, that's actually one of the reasons why Beatty was considering him. We're going back to 65, 66. You're absolutely right, Fahrenheit 451, there's Truffaut doing that. Hollywood is really actively courting him at that point to make a really kind of like mainstream Hollywood feature, and it doesn't play out, but it almost did play out. We could have had Truffaut in the director's chair, sure.
Yeah, and as you see, you talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Like, I didn't start watching Truffaut, I'm getting into Truffaut until maybe about a couple of years ago. So I had seen Close Encounters a lot of times as a kid, and I never, of course, at that time didn't know who that was. And then I watched it after I went through a Truffaut binge. I'm like, oh my God, that's François Truffaut.
Well, I remember the one time I saw him actually was in 1979 at the Kennedy Center. They were doing speaking of homages, they were doing a tribute to Truffaut. And he spoke at the Kennedy Center in the Eisenhower Theater and filled it. It was, I mean, how many directors could claim that almost a couple thousand people would turn out to see the director. And I've always kicked myself because one way I remember the blizzard of 79 was I was to have interviewed Truffaut the next day, but there was a huge snowstorm in Baltimore and Washington and everything was canceled. And because actually it was a Sunday night, we were in Washington to see Truffaut speak at the Kennedy Center, and I was to go back the next day to do an interview, but that was like a really big snowstorm. I mean, like, you know, 2 feet of snow kind of thing. And I thought, you know, people said, isn't the snow wonderful? You know, you can just look at the flakes come down and go skiing and this and that. And I thought, no, I hate it. I'll never talk to Truffaut now.
So what we talked a lot about New Hollywood, how this example. I want to talk a little bit about the performances. You know, Beatty was already a big star, but we already see Dunaway was already this was the film that sort of made Faye Dunaway, and also this was, I think, was this the first role for Gene Hackman in a movie?
Yeah, I want to talk a bit about that too, because this film really does mark a kind of sea change, old Hollywood to new Hollywood, and you can see it in the casting and in those performances. But to backtrack briefly, it's not a total break in the sense that if you look at the director, Arthur Penn, he'd been around since the 1950s in television and then segueing into feature films. And look at his credits like Left-Handed Gun in 57, Miracle Worker 62, Mickey 1 64, The Chase 65. You know, he's got a track record as a director, and he's the one who's hired by Warren Beatty. So one thing was, he's of that generation of directors that came out of television and, mm-hmm. and out of live theater. And as they, he's of that generation, let's say, as Robert Altman, directors mm-hmm. like that. Who
Peckinpah, Lumet.
Yeah, exactly. Sidney Lumet and Peckinpah. These are the guys who typically worked in live television, and you learn fast in live television. Live television and theater and so on. And they segue into feature filmmaking late 50s into the 60s. Altman's a bit of a latecomer in that respect. But the point here is that they do have some continuity with show business, if you will, going back actually to the 50s. And so he was a confident director in that sense. And also, if you look at the credits I just mentioned, he's pushing envelopes there. As a filmmaker, he is, you know, very innovative, very bold with a lot of what he's doing. He's the perfect choice, actually, but Warren Beatty hired him. And segueing from that into the actors, I mean, over the years, I actually met Arthur Penn and Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway and, you know, to at least talk with them for a few minutes. And in meeting all of them, as they talked about Bonnie and Clyde, because I asked about Bonnie and Clyde, they all adamantly acknowledge the extent to which this is the film that changed their careers. Arthur Penn had been around for a while, as I say, but this is the movie, he was on the map, if you will, but this was the one that really put him on the map, really made him a name director. Warren Beatty, since, you know, around 1960, 61, had been a movie star, but this is the film that really made him a huge movie star. Faye Dunaway, this is the movie that took her from nothing to something. For a brief period of time, you know, from this film into the 70s, she's one of the leading American actresses. It doesn't last too long, but she's a big deal for those years. And it's really significant that this is the movie that made her that. But, you know, it was kind of cruel there because she was such a movie star and such a diva, frankly. And in her own way, she's a new movie star, but she had kind of an old-fashioned attitude about such things. She had like an old glamour model there of what a movie star should be. Because I met her in more recent years, and she is a testament, whether positive or negative, to the powers of plastic surgery. And her face was pulled so tight. I'd never played the drums, but I was going to play the drums. and I shouldn't joke about this in the sense that, you know, what happens when you're a really beautiful actress and you have that window of opportunity, that opening to be a huge movie star. And she is, and in some really cutting edge movies, but essentially I would say she's an old fashioned movie star in terms of the, you know, the image she projects and so on. What happens when you get to a certain age as an actor, and we've talked about this on the program before, Warren Beatty survived that transition better than she did. And it's not a comment on their acting skills whatsoever. It's a larger and maybe damning comment on American societal values. Warren Beatty could still play romantic leads.
In his 50s.
Oh, and beyond, right? But when you're Faye Dunaway, once you get to that age, you're not getting the offers you once had. And so she's still around. She's almost sort of like desperate to work even. I mean, you know, wants to keep going, but you don't get, the phone doesn't ring. You don't get the offers. Whereas, you know, Warren Beatty, by choice, was very selective. He didn't take that many roles, but he could still select roles when he wanted them. Faye Dunaway, I think, honestly, was hungry for work and she just wasn't getting good roles, wasn't getting good offers. And, you know, she, in certain roles, she's a really good actor, but she's just not getting the opportunities. But back to your original question or observation, for Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, they become, I mean, he already was a star, but they become huge stars because of this. They become, it goes beyond like getting movie roles. In pop culture, you become a name, you become an image. People know that. And people have that curiosity about the personal lives and this and that. You know, you're in the pop culture firmament because of this film.
Yeah, and then you were talking about them. the other actress, I would have to say this is one of the most irritating performances, the character of Blanche. And it's like one of the two most irritating characters of all time for me in movies are Willie in Short Round and Temple of Doom. And I think she ranks above there just because every time in the movie she's going, yeah!
Right up there with Jabba the Hutt?
Yeah.
Even here's the thing. Now, Estelle Parsons, who plays Blanche, won the Academy Award for Best Supporting, and deserved to, because how many people could be so irritating, so convincingly? But, you know, to speak up for the character for a moment at least, she comes from good Bible-thumping heritage. Mm-hmm. You know, Blanche, I mean, she really, like, she was like a, you know, fundamentalist family, and she marries her husband, who's not the brightest bulb, you know, and he's a two-bit criminal, and she's basically a loyal spouse. And when it was two-bit crimes, okay, he goes away to the penitentiary for a bit, and he comes home, and she probably gives him a lecture, and then it goes back to normal. So anyway, she's living a more or less normal life, and now she's swept up in this incredible criminal escapade. And once they start killing bank guards and cops and so on, it's like off the charts with the threat to them. And poor Blanche is just hysterical with, I don't want to be here. And she and Bonnie have such a hate-hate relationship. and Blanche's preferred mode of communication is the screech.
Yes.
And as we're talking here, I can hear it in my ears.
Me too.
It's that thing you can never forget. She is one of the most irritating screen characters. But you know what? And for me, all joking aside, incredibly sympathetic by the end, because by the end, that Texas Ranger, that malign Texas Ranger who's out for revenge, why does he want to get Bonnie and Clyde? When he brings Blanche in for questioning, you know, she's essentially blinded and injured psychologically and physically. And when he talks to her, the way she opens up and talks and the way she cries and all, that's an incredibly moving scene. And I really feel so sorry for her. I would not want to be married to her. I would not want to be in the same household as Blanche. I don't want to be on the same street when she's screeching as she runs after a car because she wants to make the getaway too. But at that moment where she's being interrogated, I thought, this poor woman. And the way Arthur Penn shoots that scene brilliantly, the way she's set up in the room, the way she's interrogated, where you realize that this poor woman's life has been destroyed by what she's gone through. And she's not a bad person. Again, she's not the brightest or the funniest or the anythingest. You know what I mean? She's like really ordinary salt of the earth kind of character. And it's easy maybe to even make fun of her for the way she talks and that high pitch and this and that. But she doesn't deserve what's happened to her.
I do even notice in that scene when she starts crying at the end, it looks like she's about to screech or something. The door shuts just right before.
Well, that's why it's so brilliant. Arthur Penn, he shoots it. It's like involved. There's some close-ups, but also detached. There's some medium long shots even where you see her sort of isolated in the middle of the room and bandaged and really in desperate shape. And you're right. And then the door closes at just the right moment in terms of the suffering she's gone through. And in a way that's very sympathetic. Like this poor woman, we've shared her suffering. Let's close the door on it. She's been through enough here. Well, you know, Estelle Parsons is still around. She's in her late 80s now. She's still acting primarily on stage. She was at the Kennedy Center and something within the last few years. She's still very much on the scene as an actor. And this is her, you know, her great screen role and primarily a stage actor. But people, you know, think very fondly of her because of this film. And again, I know what you're saying. I'm not sure how much of that screeching I can take. But I've got to admire her because not everybody could do it that convincingly.
You are right about that. Okay, you know this whole show we've been talking about how this really ushered in the new Hollywood era. All this talk really about new Hollywood. When you really think about it, it didn't really last that long because the big end of it is, of course, the blockbuster era. You could say it ended with the big blockbuster of Jaws in 75 or Star Wars in 77. And when you had like later new Hollywood movies like Sorcerer, which went right up against Star Wars and bombed massively, and then Heaven's Gate in 1980, which was a huge disaster. It seemed at that time it was really when you saw that coming to an end, and you saw everything was about making the big summer blockbusters.
Well, yes, and thank you for saying that, because the 1970s really is a kind of golden age creatively for filmmakers, and the so-called movie brats, whether Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Brian De Palma, Martin Scorsese, etc., they are that film school generation. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they're credentialed in film schools. They come out, they start working, sometimes with Spielberg, for instance, in television, or in films working for Roger Corman, let's say, low budget, and then graduating pretty quickly to the big leagues. They make really bold films into and through most of the 70s. And then Pauline Kael actually became disenchanted as film critic at the New Yorker magazine for a few reasons. One was that she loved writing about those breakthrough films. She was less enchanted by some of what they went on to make and what other people were making in the box office world. Spielberg, you know, I admire him tremendously as a filmmaker, you know, like some films more than others. Technically, you know, props to him and just, you know, staying power and versatility and all those good things. But he deserves both praise and blame here because when Jaws came out in 1975, it was the first summer blockbuster in a way we take for granted. It changed the dynamics of the film industry. And filmmakers who had been making really nervy films like Bonnie and Clyde increasingly either couldn't get funding to make movies like that or themselves were evolving in such a way that they were going for box office success. You combine that with the evolution of special effects in movies and audience expectations change so that by the end of the decade, the 70s ain't what it used to be. And, you know, I was on the scene then and I could chart that as to sometimes there was some self-blame. Heaven's Gate is the perfect example of where the directorial ego is even larger than the budget and everything collapses and it can bring down a studio or nearly bring it down. And it makes producers understandably all the warier about giving some hotshot young director a lot of money. And so things are changing at that point. It's a complicated discussion because it's not as if it's overnight or if it's absolute, but definitely things are starting to change. And so by the time you get into the late 70s, it's a wild ride in that you have really bold films like Apocalypse Now still coming out, but that's a story unto itself. And then you have a number of other films where you would say the directors have either sold out or they're just working in a kind of conventional, safe, mainstream way. And audience taste there is dictating that as much as anything. And certainly by the late 70s, certainly by the early 80s, it helps explain why the 70s is a more exciting decade than the 80s for Hollywood filmmaking.
Yeah, and I remember listening, reading an interview from William Friedkin, and he was talking about Sorcerer. And then when he saw Star Wars for the first time, because that movie came around the same time as Star Wars, the first one, he said, oh my God, we're not going to make any money. Because he saw, like, that's what the public is more receptive to, and Sorcerer, this movie, is just not going to do anything anymore.
Well, I remember going to see Star Wars when it came out in 77 and honestly was not a big fan of it, partly for the reasons we're citing and for various other reasons. But the one thing that had me kind of depressed as I walked out was thinking, things really have changed here, or things really are changing. And I want to still surf the zeitgeist, of course, if that's where things are going or how they're changing. I want to be part of that. I don't want to be part of that dustbin of history.
You don't want to be Bosley Crowther.
Well, no, I don't want to be the next Bosley Crowther. But in terms of those changes, I realized that, well, you know, audience taste is changing here. Directors are responding to it. And I want to be around to see what's happening. But I realized quite honestly that I wasn't always going to like what I was seeing, or not like it as much as the films that I really took to heart. Because you can look at those movie brat directors and what they were making from the late 60s through the 70s, and a lot of really exciting work. And some of them continue to do that. But then you look at some of the others and you realize, well, still a gifted director, but maybe for my purposes, for my taste, a bit more checkered in terms of films I like, others not so much. But sometimes, frankly, films that I call kind of like sellout films. Like, you know, you're doing this as box office. Or, you know, in Coppola's case, you have debts to pay. You know, you take something for the paycheck. And those careers have some bumps along the way, don't they, a little further in?
Yeah, and it's like we talk about the box office now, where even at that time with Star Wars and Jaws, it was always primarily the summer. But like now, you can just release a big budget blockbuster like anytime. I mean, look at right now what we got now with Black Panther. That movie's probably going to gross $1 billion. It's come out in February.
The traditional release patterns, the seasons, if you will, have changed radically. You're absolutely right. When Jaws came out, it was so notable as being a summer blockbuster because summer hitherto had been more of a dumping ground. And now the biggest pictures, the biggest budgets, the largest draws towards the summer. And then what happens, like, well, why restrict it to the summer? Yeah. So what would have been, and a film like Jaws would have been a B movie just 10 or 20 years earlier. It wouldn't have been an A picture. But what happens now is you get B movie material with A movie budgets and promotion, and the dynamics shift significantly. What would have been a Roger Corman type picture years before is now a mainstream release. That's a whole other discussion right there. But the fact that the calendar changes, that kind of movie now is released year round. Another very quick example is, what is a Christmas picture anymore? It used to be a film released in early to mid or through late December, and that was your prestige year-end Christmas picture. Now the Christmas pictures open around Thanksgiving, don't they, or even a little
even
sooner.
Earlier.
And some of them are so overtly Christmas pictures that I don't want to think about Christmas shopping yet. It's the equivalent of the retail scene. In other words, you know, you go into a big box retailer in late summer, early fall, and they have the Christmas merchandise out. Hollywood is no different. The Christmas merchandise is out.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything else about Bonnie and Clyde or anything else that you want to bring up?
Well, with Bonnie and Clyde, I would just urge people not only to see it or to see it again, but simply watch it as filmmaking, as craft. It's exceptionally well made. I mean, think about it in terms of just how the scenes are staged. Think one thing we haven't mentioned, the really brilliant use of music. And the you know that jaunty banjo driven score there, even when they're doing, or especially when they're doing like really really illegal things, holding up banks, making the getaway, the music is so cheerful. Oftentimes, it helps to engender that sense of them as folk heroes, as people who get away with it, and also the way that's modulated. Some of the scenes are effective because they don't have any music. It's a virtue sometimes not to have a soundtrack crashing around you. Sometimes the sound is taking that, or it's just natural sound. So think about the ways in which the camera work, the editing, the use of sound are so carefully controlled by Arthur Penn and his creative partners that when you get swept up in the story, one reason you don't think about those things is because you're swept up in the story. But go back and watch it again and think about it in terms of the craft of filmmaking.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing the 1967 classic Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks, I enjoyed it.
Okay. For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, we rob banks.